Okay, so this week, having discussed a lot of Islamic history and the development of Islam, and having also discussed Islamic law, we're going to look at the mystical tradition in Islam, which is largely under the title of Sufism. And it focuses very much on the inner journey to discover God, and many other religious traditions have that too. You know, that's not unique to Islam. And I would say that probably all major religions have a mystical path, or a mystical side to them, perhaps, or movements within them. We ourselves have what started off as Merkava mysticism or Hekhalot mysticism, which was an early form, and then in the Middle Ages developed into the Kabbalah. And there have been various schools of Kabbalah, and many of which survive till today. And of course, in the 18th century, we have the Hasidic movement, which bases itself on Kabbalistic ideas and takes them in new directions. So we have quite an active mystical tradition ourselves. So the Islamic mystical tradition is known as Sufism, but it's not a unified and organized movement any more than Hasidism is. It's a particular type of sort of side to the religion, if you like. And it's known as Tasawwuf, is the original. From you can hear Tasawwuf, Sufi, that's where it comes from. That's the name of it. Its origins are quite obscure. Some Western scholars, so now we're talking the outside the faith view, see it as a continuation both of the Hellenistic Neoplatonist philosophy of the last sort of third, fourth century CE, or possibly of some Nestorian Christian ideas. So Neoplatonism is itself a religious and mystical school of philosophy. The leading philosopher of Neoplatonism was called Plotinus. And it's like Sufism, it's based on the idea that there's a single unknowable and unnameable one. That would be God for monotheistic religions. And from this absolutely unified one emanate successive spheres of being. And these spheres of being mirror the quality of the original and undivided one, but they also gradually become multiple. And eventually they descend to the sphere of the material world as we know it. And so all being in this view, including us as humans, emanates from the ultimate one. And as a result, we and everything else in creation are drawn back to get back close to and be reabsorbed in that one and unite with it. And that's the ultimate task of human beings, is to free the soul from the captivity of the illusions of this world and to return to perfect unity with the one. You might notice similarities there with some ideas in Kabbalism. The idea of the Kabbalistic spheres of emanation, the Sfirot, is again, there's probably Neoplatonist influence on that too, certainly from an academic point of view. So the journey to and the eventual reunification with God is the central project of Sufism. And the word Sufi itself means wool, rather unusually, and that leads us to the second possible origins of Sufism. In Nestorian Christianity, that's an Eastern form of Christianity that wasn't, well, it lost the battle to be mainstream, should we say, early on. And wool in Nestorian Christianity was the symbol of very holy ascetics, people who lived as hermits and gave up all worldly pleasures in order to get close to God. So that sort of association of wool and holy poverty, the remembrance of God, there's something very like that in Nestorian Christianity called the Jesus Prayer. The idea of a spiritual journey with stages on it, all that might suggest that there are some ideas that are pre-Islamic that might actually go back to Christianity as well as the Neoplatonist influence, and that might have performed the sort of the bed layer, if you like, of what developed later on into Sufism. Now, that's not the way Sufis themselves would see it. They would say, no, it all goes back to Muhammad, and very often, in fact, via his cousin and son-in-law Ali, who of course is also very important to Shiites as well, but Ali is very important to Sufis. They often quote a hadith about Muhammad and Ali. So let's see if I can share. Wait a moment, share screen. Here we are. Okay, so there's this early hadith. Muhammad said, "I am the city of knowledge, and Ali is its gate." So Sufis take that as seeing Muhammad as the founder of this mystical path towards God, and Ali is also very important in it. And there are also quite a lot of verses in the Quran that are very much Well, they couldn't be interpreted in a very mystical way, shall we say. That's probably the easiest way to say it. One particularly beloved verse to Sufis is this one from Quran, Surah number 2, chapter 2. To God belong the east and the west. Wheresoever you turn, there is the face of God. God is all-encompassing, knowing. So that has the seeds of the mystical idea that God encompasses and indeed constitutes ultimate reality, so that everything that exists is one within God, if you like. The whole of everything we know exists within the being of God. In Sufi terms, that's an idea known as the oneness of being, the wahdat al-wujud, and that became quite a central idea in Sufi thought, especially in the works of the very prominent thinker Ibn Arabi, who died in 1240 and who was one of the great philosophers of the Muslim world, but also was a Sufi mystic at the same time as being a philosopher. And that idea of the oneness of all being within God, it also has a technical term, panentheism. It's not the same as pantheism, it's panentheism. Everything is inside God, rather pantheism is God is everywhere, or you know, God can be found everywhere. So panentheism does appear in Buddhism, in Hinduism, in some aspects of late Kabbalah as well. So again, it's a mystical idea that's not unique to Sufism. It's quite well known in many mystical traditions. Another very important verse for Sufis, and not just for Sufis, is what's known as the light verse, Ayat an-Nur. And this is from the 24th chapter of the Quran. God is the light of the heavens and the earth. His light is like this. There is a niche, and in it a lamp, the lamp inside a glass like a glittering star, fueled from a blessed olive tree from neither east nor west, whose oil almost gives light even when no fire touches it. Light upon light. God guides whoever he will to his light. God draws such comparisons for people. God has full knowledge of everything. So this is a parable or a comparison. It's actually labeled as such. God draws such comparisons. In the Arabic word is mithl, which is a bit like mashal in Hebrew. So it's quite difficult to decode. What exactly does it mean? And there are many, many interpretations. Some people see the lamp here as the Quran. Some people see the lamp as Muhammad. Some connect the light of God with the knowledge of God. God knows everything. His light is everywhere and he sees everything. And these multiple interpretations, of course, are very useful if you are a mystical turn of mind, because you can use this verse as a starting point for many, many ideas about the nature of God and his revelation to the world and the nature of God's knowledge and so on and so forth. So there's a lot of Quranic material. These are just two of the possible verses that mystics love to use. There's a lot of Quranic material that was heavily used in the mystical tradition and which the mystics of Islam saw as their source material. This is where it comes from. It was, you know, nothing to do with Neoplatonists and Nestorian Christians. This is where Islam gets it from in the faith tradition. So again, we have an outside the faith tradition saying, yeah, well, you know, maybe there are these earlier influences. And then we have an inside the faith tradition saying, no, it comes directly from the Quran and Muhammad was the first mystic. So again, it's helpful to notice that depending on where you are, you might have different understandings of how Sufism starts. It is very, very clear that very early on, there was a mystical tendency in Islam. And there are early traditions that one of Muhammad's own companions, Abu Dharr al-Ghifari, was an ascetic. In other words, he probably did a lot of fasting and deprivation of sensual pleasures, etc. And he was seen by later Sufis to be the model of a fakir. And a fakir, you may have heard of fakirs in India, but a fakir means a poor person. And again, it's somebody who embraces poverty to earn the riches of God. They throw away all attachment to this world in order to investigate true spiritual understanding. And again, that's a model that we know in many, many religions. That's one of the ideas underlying Christian monasticism. Sufis tended not to be celibate. They were often married. So that's not quite the same. But this idea of denying yourself the world or cutting yourself off from the world in order to explore inner spirituality is also known in Hinduism, Buddhism, Some Kabbalists very much were quite isolated mystics, or had a mystical life alongside their worldly life. There were people like Rabbi Yosef Karo, who wrote the Shulchan Aruch, also had a very lively mystical life, and wrote a mystical diary in which he talks about the Mishnah as appearing to him and speaking to him and inspiring him. So Sufis sometimes would combine that. They would sometimes combine a life as an official, could be a judge or this or that, with a mystical inner life, or they might actually go off and be hermits or separate themselves from society in order to concentrate on this aspect of their lives a bit more. It's quite a wide varying tradition, not quite as clear cut as Christian monasticism. So this early companion of Muhammad, Abu Dhar al-Ghifari, was seen as the model of a fakir. People should imitate him. Another very important early figure in Sufism was Rabia, a female mystic. She died in 801 CE, and she was known for her poetry and particularly for her emphasis on the love of God. She didn't actually leave any writings. It would have been oral poetry. And everything we know about her actually comes from a much later writer, a 13th century writer on mysticism called Al-Attar, who wrote his own mystical works, but also wrote about Rabia. So at this stage of history, we can't disentangle what is legend and what is historical about Rabia. She clearly did exist. And she's very well known in the Muslim world and very beloved. And here's one of her prayers. Speaking directly to God, she says, "If I adore you out of fear of hell, burn me in hell. If I adore you out of desire for paradise, lock me out of paradise. But if I adore you for yourself alone, do not deny to me your eternal beauty." Which is a little bit reminiscent of things in Pirkei Avot, which say, don't serve God out of fear. Don't serve God as a slave serves his master. The idea is that you should have a pure love for God, not inspired by either the fear of punishment or the expectation of reward. You should love God for God's self. And there are a lot of very charming legends or stories about Rabia, a particularly nice one. There was a contemporary mystic called Hasan al-Basri, who was much more into the fear of God. So Rabia was very much the love of God, and Hasan al-Basri was the fear of God. And there are quite a few stories about the meeting. And one particularly nice one has Hasan seeing Rabia one day near a lake, and he threw his prayer rug on the top of the water, where it was floated, and said, "Rabia, come and let us pray here." Because he was a mystic, he could float his prayer rug on top of the water and pray on top of it without sinking. And she replied, "Hasan, when you are showing off your spiritual goods in the worldly market, it should be things which your fellow men cannot display." And she said this, and she threw her prayer rug up into the air where it floated, and she flew up onto it and said, "Come on up here, Hasan, where people can see us." And then she said, "Hasan, what you did, fishes can do. And what I did, flies can do. But the real business is outside these tricks. One must apply oneself to the real business." In other words, showy miracles are not important. The important thing is the quest for God. So don't try showing off just because you're a holy person who can do miracles. So, and there are a lot of popular books about Rabia. As I said, she's familiar to modern Muslims, very much so. A lot of women called Rabia after her. Only from the 10th century on is there a really coherent tradition of Sufism. It was clearly quite various and people did their own thing. But from then on, Sufi writers began to gather earlier ideas and practices and assemble them into a sort of a system much more. Some works that were written then were anthologies of earlier sayings and stories. Others spent a lot of time analyzing the mystical journey towards God and would produce manuals on how to go on that journey. One of the most influential manuals of this sort was written by Kushairi. It's called The Epistle on on Sufism. You can see it. He died in 1074, so it's earlier than that. And he documents in this letter, this epistle, 42 stages or states on the journey towards God. And there were quite a lot of this type of manual that would map out the path for you, and you could measure how far along you had got and know what you had to do next. For For Kushairi, the first thing you have to do is repent. The idea of, very much like our idea of tshuva, you return to God. That's the first thing that you do. And you turn away from the material world in order to seek God. And I've just taken out a few of the later stages. This is, they're in the right order, but they're not necessarily one after the other. Mujahada, which of course is related to the idea of jihad, a struggle. Here it's struggle in within yourself. Striving or struggling is essentially weaning the soul of its habitual practices and compelling it to oppose its passions at all times. So this idea of spiritual self-control. Zucht, which is ascetic renunciation. The spiritual pilgrim has put aside even permissible pleasures in order to pursue the path single-mindedly. So again, this theme of asceticism, of not indulging in worldly pleasures. Sampt, which is silence. There are two types of silence, outer silence and the silence of the heart and mind. The heart of one who trusts completely in God is silent, not demanding any means for living. Instead of bothering God with prayers for please can have more money or more children or more this or success, the heart of somebody who truly trusts in God doesn't make requests. It's silent. It just contemplates God as far as it can. Then we have a particularly important concept in Sufism, dhikr. Sometimes you'll see it written as zikr with a Z. Dhikr means remembrance. We'll come back to it later and talk about it in more detail. But here it's seen as a stage on the way to God. No one reaches God save by continual remembrance of him. There are two kinds of remembrance, that of the tongue and that of the heart. The servant, i.e. the servant of God, attains perpetual remembrance of the heart by making vocal remembrance. In other words, by repeating phrases or the name of God continually. And as we'll see a bit later, that's one of the central practices of Sufis. Let me get on to mahabba, love. Love is a state experienced in the heart, too subtle for words. This state brings the seeker, to glorify God and to try to gain his pleasure. He has little patience in separation from him, feels an urgent longing for him, finds no comfort in anything other than him, and experiences intimacy in his heart by making continual remembrance of him. And you note that remembrance appears here too. And if any of you have ever studied the last chapter of Rambam's Hilchot Shuvah, his Laws of Repentance in the Mishneh Torah, that will sound quite familiar. He writes something very, very close to this there. Then we've got two more, shalk, yearning or passionate longing. Longing is the state of commotion in the heart, hoping to meet the beloved, of course, being God. And for Sufis, the final point on this journey towards God is fana, which is annihilation of the self, sometimes called the dying before death. Now, early Sufis seem to have seen this as a recognition of the will of God, or the abandonment of being conscious of yourself, replacing it with contemplating only God so that you're just forgetful of self. You annihilate yourself in the face of God. Some Sufis took it further. And they phrased it as the breaking down of the individual ego and the recognition of the fundamental unity of God, the creation of the individual self. So this recognition of the oneness of being. And an even more extreme understanding that was followed by certainly some of the early mystics too, was that fana, annihilation, means the total annihilation of the self, that the ego is absolutely destroyed and the seeker actually achieves total union with God. And that was espoused by an early mystic called Al-Halaj, who was killed for his views. He was in a state of mystical ecstasy, and he proclaimed in the marketplace of Baghdad, Ana al-Haq, which means I am the truth. Well, Al-Haq is one of the names of God. So he was essentially saying, I am God, which he probably did mean too, because he probably felt he'd achieved union with God. And the local authorities weren't very happy about that, and he was executed. So occasionally, Sufis have got into trouble. This idea of absolute fading into God, the sort of the annihilation of your own being and becoming totally one with God. Later Sufis seem to have felt that he was right, actually. And so the very famous 13th century master Rumi, who we'll talk about in a moment, seems to have followed this view. He said, when Al-Halaj said, I am God, I am truth, and carried it through, he vanquished all the skeptics. When a man's I is negated and eliminated from existence, then what remains? Consider, O denier. In other words, if you have flattened out, if you've destroyed your own ego, all that can remain is God. So Al-Halaj was right. I just saw somebody put their hand up. Or maybe they put the question in the chat. Panentheism is the philosophy of Spinoza. Yes, I think so. Rabbi Mordechai Kaplan, I know less about his philosophy, but I'm sure you're right. If I came across these passages, I would call them poetic rather than mystical. I think all mystical writing is poetic because you can't put this stuff in ordinary words. So if you read some bits of the Zohar, extremely poetic in our terms. There's a Yiddish prayer attributed to the first Chabad Rebbe that's similar to Rabbi's prayer. One of the things you do notice about mystical writings and mystics is how similar they are. Whatever religion they come from, they do very, very often use many similar ideas. They would say that's because, you know, these are ideas of truth. So of course they're similar. other people might say, oh, well, you know, there's historical influence, but they are very pervasive and you can find many, many ideas in multiple traditions, including ideas, as we said before, of the annihilation of the self. I don't think I saw the person who put their hand up. I didn't see their question in the chat. So do they want to put their hand up again? I can't see any hands up at the moment. I don't know if Maxine, if you can see a hand up. The trouble is when I've got the handout up.
No problem. I saw the hand go up and then go down pretty quickly, so I think it may have just been a mistake.
Okay, so we can always come back to the question if it comes up later. Yeah. So we were talking about the annihilation of the self and what this might mean, the very extreme claims that meant that you actually become part of God or you cease to be you. There is only God in place of where there was originally your individual being. For some non-Sufi Muslims, this comes very close to heresy, asserting that a human being could become part of God or is part of God's unity, God's tawhid, which is an essential principle in Islam. And this idea often got Sufis in trouble with local authorities, non-mystical authorities, and we'll come back to that later as well. So we said that you can see these ideas very often in different mystical traditions, and actually many of these ideas or similar ideas can be seen in contemporary Jewish sources from the time. And even later sources too. We have quite a lot of manuals of the journey to God. We've got the very famous Misilat Yesharim, The Path of the Upright by Moshe Chaim Luzzatto. We have Rabbi Yonah Gerondi's Sha'arei Tshuva, which is, again, a manual. We have the anonymous 14th century Orchot Tzadikim, The Ways of the Righteous. We mentioned already Rambam on his love of God in the last of the Hilchot Tshuva. And even the concept of fana is quite paralleled by the Kabbalistic concept of bitul hayesh, the annihilation of that which is. So again, you know, these ideas are not unknown in Judaism at all. The most Sufi-like, or actually Sufi of all classical Jewish masters, was Rambam's son, Abraham, the son of the Rambam, who died in 1237. He was deeply, deeply influenced by Sufism. He introduced Sufi practices into his shul, like lots of prostrations and ablutions, praying while standing in rows and so on. And he wrote a huge book called the Kifaya, which has not actually completely survived. I think we just have quotations of it here and there. Three quarters of it was going over a lot of his father's work. But the fourth quarter is basically it's one of these manuals of how to walk the tariqa, the path towards God. And it's very, very like contemporary Sufi manuals, and sort of indistinguishable from them. He also advocates you know, the following, the path till divine union with God is actually achieved, as something that wasn't always accepted in Jewish mysticism any more than it was in Islamic mysticism. And he says that when you get that far, you then change your clothing. And the clothing he specifies to be worn is Sufi clothing. And he also he says that that's what he wore. So it implies that he not only wrote about the path, he actually completed it himself. So he is that a lot has been written in the academic world about his ideas and their closeness to Sufi ideas. So clearly it was seen as a path that transcended particular religions, you could see, to a certain extent. Okay, so there are different numbers of steps in these things, 42 or 49, you know, it depends. And, you know, you can always find rationalization for them. But yes, different manuals have different stages, different numbers of stages in the journey, both Jewish and Muslim. So the great Sufi masters were themselves masters of spiritual psychology, you could say. part of the Sufi way, both in earlier times and now, is the attachment of the spiritual seeker to a spiritual master. He's often called, I think, yes, put the words down here, a peer, that's a Persian word, means an old man, a shaykh, which also means an elder, a murshid, which is Arabic, means a guide. And this guide is entrusted with teaching the Sufi seeker, who could be male or female, on this journey. And this path of transformation is seen as the ideal for every individual by Sufis. The student takes an oath of allegiance to the teacher and is then called a murid, a guided one, a person who is in that particular relationship. It's a little bit like the Hasid to Rebbe relationship, with the Rebbe being the peer or the Shaykh or the Murshid, and the Hasid being the Murid. It's that very much that personal, deeply, deeply spiritual relationship there too. And in the Sufi world, the generations of those links are very much documented. So it's seen as a long link of spiritual mastership and discipleship that reaches all the way back to Muhammad. And the Sufi masters will give their spiritual genealogy back to the person who taught them and who taught them, et cetera, and all the way down. So they're well documented. I can't say if they're historical or not, who knows. And within the Sufi world, there are several brotherhoods or orders, if you like, several paths. They actually call it a tariqa, which literally means a path, but you could translate it also as order. Sometimes people belong to more than one. There are people who belong to three or four sometimes. They're not mutually exclusive. They have particular traditions in each one. They're usually named after their founders. And the initiates see themselves as very much preserving and transmitting the founders' teachings. And again, it's not so different from Hasidic sects, actually. It sometimes involves particular types of clothing, too. The tariqas run lodges where rituals are performed and instruction is given. And some orders even have rather monastery-like institutions, the Bektashia, for instance. You know, they still do, but they certainly used to have rather monastery-like celibate institutions. The welcoming of women, it sort of depends a bit which order it is and where it is also. So each tariqa is led by a master, very often the son of the previous master. So you have dynasties, again, like the Hasidic world of spiritual masters. There are often legends, lots and lots of legends about the early masters. And very frequently, their tombs are places of pilgrimage, particularly in North Africa. There's a whole culture of tomb visiting and tomb festivities on the anniversary of death of the master. Again, links straight into the Sephardi tradition of hilulas to mark the deaths of particularly important rabbis. Some people still travel back to Morocco to, for instance, the Abu Khadzera tombs and so on. And certainly in Morocco, both Muslims and Jews shared some of those tombs and would quite impartially go to the hilulas of each particular religion. Many of those tombs still exist. I actually saw a film very recently about many of the, it was about dozens of the Jewish tombs of almost the equivalent of Sufi masters all over Morocco, many of which these days are being looked after by Muslim families who open them up for visitors. And there are visitors occasionally from Israel to come and see these. So people definitely have attachments built to a particular shrine, to a particular tariqa, but they'll also visit other ones if there are a lot of these tombs around. So pilgrimage and festivals are very much features of the traditional Sufi world. Here are some of the main tariqas. I mean, there are lots and lots and lots. I'm not going to go through this whole table, but you can see that they're found in different places. So the Qadariya are all over the place. The Surawdiya are more Pakistan and the subcontinent. The Naqshbandiya, well, there was an active lodge in Jerusalem in the old city. The sheikh there, who died very tragically at a young age, was a major, major interfaith and peace building activist in Jerusalem. And the Naqshbandiya center there may still be, I don't know what's happened since he died. It was a very major center of meeting of Jews and Christians and Muslims. The Mavlaviyya we're going to talk about in a little bit more detail. They're in Turkey because their founder, Jalal ad-Din Rumi, who you might just know as Rumi, is very, very famous. I want to look at him as an example of a particular a particular Sufi master who founds one of these tariqas. They are also, you might have heard of the whirling dervishes, they're mevliya. Again, it's a Sufi practice, and we'll talk about that in a moment too. Another one that's interesting is the Chishtiyah. They started off in India, they're all over the world. Again, they're very, very involved in interfaith stuff. So I know some Chishtiyah Sufis, and they are very active in interfaith and peace activities and so on and so forth. So those are just some of them. There are many, many more. Some orders have flourished for a while and don't exist anymore. Some still exist and go back a long way, some are later. So again, you'd have to look at the history of each one to get a full picture. So what do Sufis actually do? Well, they do have distinctive rituals. You know, they'll all do the standard prayers and what have you, but they'll have particular rituals that are associated with their tariqa, their particular order, and they're known as wird. Often it's set recitations involving prayers of penitence and blessing of Muhammad and his family, and dhikr. And dhikr is universal, really, to all Sufis. Dhikr is the remembrance of God, very often by chanting God's name aloud. So they'll just say Allah, Allah, Allah. Or I've actually heard it done in a Western setting, people just saying God, 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 and just meditating on God's name. And that's important to all Sufis. It's also very much based on the Quran itself, which mentions the remembrance of God. So here's from chapter 13, those who believe and those whose hearts are set at rest by the remembrance of Allah, by the remembrance of God. Now, surely by Allah's remembrance, our hearts set at rest. So this idea that you should remember God constantly without ceasing, whatever you're doing, there should, you know, God should be the refrain of your life. And there are different ways of doing dhikr. It can be accompanied by music. It can be accompanied by dance or other types of movements. It can be accompanied by breath control exercises. It can be done out loud. It can be done silently. As we said, ideally, it's constant. People will listen to YouTubes of dhikrs performed by Sufi masters. I've put one here, which I think is, I don't watch it for an hour, but you get the idea after a minute or two. But it just consists of a Sufi devotee just reciting there is no God but God for an hour straight in a particular melody. So there are quite a lot of those all over YouTube, and people do use them as sort of meditational aids, if you like, a bit like you know, Tibetan singing bowls and mantras and Buddhism. So again, this idea of repetition of something holy putting you into a particular spiritual state is found in all mystical traditions. We said dancing. If you have group dhikr rituals, of course, they have to be a bit more unified because they won't work if everyone's doing their own thing. So there'll often be a particular series of recitations on chanting, stylized body movements, and they'll often be orchestrated by a leader, a sort of conductor. And the unity of the chant and the unity of the movements is understood as symbolizing the unity of God and the unity of all souls in God. It can be as simple as a circle of people just chanting the name of God, but there are much more elaborate forms. And the whirling dervishes we talked about from the Mevlevia are a particularly good example. You'll only find them in Turkey. And they spin in a highly choreographed dance that is centered on the Shaykh, on the master of the order. And they represent Mevlevi ideas of how the cosmos is organized. So the idea of the one at the center and the idea of the master as the early earthly manifestation of the axis of the universe, in imitation almost of Muhammad, who's also seen as the axis of the universe. And that axis on which the spheres of being, the spheres of existence revolve, hence the whirling in one place, round and round and round. You can see that on YouTube as well. I've seen them. I've put a little one up here because it's also got footage of Rumi's tomb and his shrine in Konya in Turkey, which is the center of the Mevlevi. And it's, yeah, so they're very meditative to watch. It's not Shiite or Sunni. It's what cuts across. So Sufism is a pan-Islamic phenomenon. And originally, the way that the whirling dervishes danced, they would fast for several hours before. And then they began to rotate on their left foot in short twists, and the right foot spins them around and around. They hold their hands one up, so they're receiving the sort of the influence of God from above, and the other one facing down, so they're transferring the blessing downwards to this world. And their eyes are open but unfocused, so that images become blurred, so they enter into this mystical state as they go round and round. And they dance the music that's there's a special band with a flute player, singer, offering singing sort of devotional chants, cymbal player, kettle drum, and the orchestra plays. Again, it's specifically Sufi traditional music for this purpose. And in the old days, they were trained for 1,001 days before they actually did the dancing. Nowadays, that doesn't happen. In those days, they would have a whole training about ethics and the codes of behavior and beliefs, and they would do a lot of practicing and a lot of religious exercises. And after the training, they were still members of the order, but they'd go back to their families. That doesn't happen so much. We'll find out why in a moment. So Sufi ideas have spread right across the Muslim world, and they extend to all aspects of Islamic culture. And it's been said that in the Middle Ages, basically, all Sufis in the world, all Muslims in the world were essentially following Sufi practices of one sort or another. And the basic, there are many Sufi musical traditions too that have survived all around the Muslim world, from Egypt to North Africa to the Indian subcontinent. And in that sense, it's still very, very much part of popular culture. And the third YouTube I put here is just a village singer, a Sufi singer, and his audience. And it's fascinating. It's about 4 or 5 minutes long, because you can see, first of all, it's very rustic. These are not educated city people. They're somewhere in the middle of Egypt. Many of them may be illiterate. And you can also see how the audience participates. They move to the singing. The singer chants and everyone's enjoying it. There are kids there, and some people just listening, and some people are humming along, and some people are clapping, and some people are doing something that looks a bit like a dance. And in this sort of style, it's really, really rooted in Islamic culture right around the world. Really well-known singers are a bit like rock stars, a bit like the Quranic recitations. So again, you can look up Sufi singers and find some very famous ones. They do a lot of recording these days. One particularly famous form of Sufi music is called Qawwali, and that's particularly in Pakistan and India. And originally it was without any musical instruments at all, but then musical instruments were permitted later on. Originally it was all men. Recently, there are female Qawwali singers. In recent decades, Qawwali has become very, very popular indeed. There are now Qawwali singers on the world music track, you know, appearing at concerts and things, including the UK. And I found a fascinating example of very highly produced, very professionally produced, very non-traditional Qawwali singer with a female singer from London. She's Indian heritage. And the lyrics she's singing are in praise of Ali and his family, but it's a very, very modern production, if you like. So that's quite interesting, sort of just seeing where Sufi culture has gone and what it's contributed in the wider scene. But Sufi influence isn't just limited to popular culture, because some of the greatest Muslim thinkers and philosophers and religious figures were Sufis. We already mentioned Ibn Arabi, who was died in the 13th century, and a major, major thinker in Islam. And again, you know, you couldn't really imagine the development of Islam without Sufi thinking, without Sufi figures. The one I want to look at today is Jalaluddin Rumi, because many, many people have heard of Rumi. We said he founded the Mevlevi Tariqah, the Mevlevi order. And he's a very interesting example. He was born in the year 1207. Up in Balkh, which is on the north border of Afghanistan these days. Back then it was part of the Persian Empire. And he and his family fled from the Mongol invasions, which we talked about earlier on in the course. They fled westwards and they ended up in what is today Turkey, in the town of Konya. And Rumi's father was a mystic as well. So he grew up in a mystical household, a Sufi household. And Rumi took over his father's rule as the leader of a local Sufi community. And in 1244, he met a stranger who was a wandering mystic, or dervish, they're sometimes called, who was called Shams, came from Tabriz in Iran. And he immediately felt a sort of mystical brotherhood with Shams, and spent all his time discussing mystical things with him. And Rumi's students got very, very jealous of the newcomer, and eventually he disappeared. And Rumi started to write mystical poetry. mostly in Persian, but some use of Arabic and Turkish. And he started devoting himself more to music and dhikr. Shams did come back and their mystical conversations continued, but then he disappeared very suddenly and it's thought he was murdered, quite possibly by Rumi's son, who was desperately jealous of him. And Rumi was desolate when he didn't come back the second time, and he went out searching for him. But he got as far as Damascus, and he had a sudden sort of epiphany, a sudden revelation, if you like, that Shams had mystically become part of him. And so this is a poem from that moment. He writes, "Why should I seek? I am the same as he. His essence speaks through me. I have been looking for myself." Of course, if as a Sufi you believe that in the Wahdat al-Wujud, the oneness of being, then somebody may have disappeared or died, but they would still be accessible to you because you're all part of the same being, the same idea. And again, that's like quite like some Buddhist ideas that there is no birth, there's no death, there's just linked existence. And Rumi wrote some of the most famous and beautiful poetry in the Sufi tradition. He claimed that Shams was writing through him, and he even called his huge output the works of Shams of Tabriz. His most famous work, which is known by many, many people, a lot of people know great chunks of it off by heart, is called the Masnawi or the Mathnawi, depending on what sort of pronunciation you want to adopt. And it's a 6-volume collection that weaves fables and stories from everyday life and Quranic revelations and interpretations and metaphysics into a very vast and intricate tapestry. It's quite difficult to take excerpts from it because it's often in the form of a fable that develops a fable within itself and another fable. So they're quite long and difficult to take bits from. For him, the search for God is the center of his existence and love is the path to God. And though he was a devout Muslim, much of his work expresses a huge degree of universalism, which has made him very, very popular in the West. And I think a recent survey showed he was the best loved poet in America. So here's an example of the universalism. He says, "What can I do, Muslims? I do not know myself. I am neither Christian nor Jew, neither Magian, so Zoroastrian, nor Muslim. I'm not from East or West, not from land or sea, not from the shafts of nature, nor from the spheres of the firmament. Not of the earth, not of water, not of air, not of fire. I am not from the highest heaven, not from this world, not from existence, not from being. I am not from India, not from China, not from Bulgar, not from Saxene," which I presume is Saxony, I'm not sure. "Not from the realm of the two Iraqs, not from the land of Khorasan," which is where he was from. "I am not from the world, not from beyond, not from heaven and not from hell. I am not from Adam, not from Eve, not from paradise, not from Ridwan." I think that's a sarcastic reference to a local city. "My place is placeless. My trace is traceless. No body, no soul. I am from the soul of souls. I have chased that duality, lived the two worlds as one." That would be this world that you can see in the world of God, the ultimate reality. "One I seek, one I know. One I see, one I call. He is the first, he is the last. He is the outer, he is the inner. Beyond he and he is, I know no other. I am drunk from the cup of love. The two worlds have escaped me." And that's quite typical of his poetry. The emphasis on love, images of drunkenness, very, very common in Sufi mystical poetry. Sufis were often accused of drinking wine, which of course is not allowed in Islam, and being drunk. It's not quite clear if they did or if it was just a metaphor that they used a great deal, but there are Persian miniatures of Sufis drinking wine and becoming totally lost in their love of God. And love poetry, again, love poetry directed towards God is very, very common in the Sufi tradition. And here's a little passage of Rumi looking at fana, this idea of the annihilation of the self. And this reflects the Persian original is actually rhymed couplets. So it's been translated into English rhymed couplets to reflect that. "How can a man praise God, the Lord of all? Be like mere dust, contemptible and small. What can man learn about God's being one? To burn themselves in him just like the sun. If like the day you wish to shine so bright, burn up your being, for that's like the night. Like copper, burn yourself with alchemy in that one who gives being generously. You've clung fast to the self of I and you, although all wretchedness stems from these two." So again, that's very much in praise of the annihilation of the distinction of the self from ultimate being. or making a mistake. If you think there's an I and a you out there, the point is to lose yourself within God and to become ultimately part of true reality. You can imagine that didn't actually enchant everybody. Non-mystics were not enthusiastic about much of this, and very wary of Sufis. They didn't care for this idea of drunkenness. It might be literal. They felt that many statements made by Sufi saints and thinkers were blasphemous, like Al-Hallaj's statement, "I am the truth." And even today, there are still some very, very strongly anti-Sufi movements. The sort of fundamentalist movements like the Wahhabis in South Saudi Arabia and Salafi groups around the world tend to hate Sufis really, really strongly. They dislike their theological ideas. They don't like the pilgrimages and prayers to saints. They see them as examples of bid'ah, which is bad innovation that you're not meant to have. All the movements that say we should return to the Quran and do nothing that's later than the Quran will be anti-Sufi. And Sufis have often also been quite prominent in interfaith stuff because of their universalism, because of this idea that distinctions are meaningless in the face of the universe, the universality that is God. And there's only one true being, then how can you fuss about what religion people are? And that has not found favor with much more narrow-minded or fundamentalist sects who just say, no, you know, they're wrong, we're right, and you shouldn't be fraternizing with other people. Sufis have often coexisted very happily with other faiths. We said, for instance, in North Africa, we were talking about them sharing with Jews local tombs. Also in India, there's a lot of overlap between Sufis and Hindus and sharing of sites and holy places. Their focus on the spiritual life led them to be charged with being very lax about formal religious rules. So you might remember that early Hasidism were accused of not praying at the right time and were thought to be lax in their observance of halakha. So it's the standard suspicion of the mystic, because the mystic might break rules. The mystic wants to dissolve rules and boundaries and distinctions, and people who don't share those ideals find that very, very threatening indeed. And their system of masters and pupils also posed a challenge to other authority systems in the Islamic world. So if we go back to the Mevlevi, to Rumi's order and their dance dhikr, the whirling dervishes, for instance, all their lodges were closed in 1925 by Kemal Atatürk as part of the secularization policy of early modern Turkey. The Turkish government began to allow performances again, though only in public, in the 1950s. And they eased the restrictions a bit in the 1990s. And there are private groups that are re-establishing the tradition of the dancing again. But the transmission, what they were able to save, was very much the music and the songs, not necessarily the whole training program that went with it. You remember that we said traditionally they spent 1,001 days training in a lodge. So that, of course, was much, much harder to maintain. So consequently, a lot of the whirling dervish performances you can see are tourist performances, and they aren't necessarily particularly associated with a religious background. They've often been shortened and simplified to be more commercial. So if you do go to Istanbul and you want to see the Mehlevi doing their dances, you'd be advised to sort of ask around and find, you know, is there a more genuine one than the one down at the hotel down the road? So in some places, Sufi culture was quite badly damaged by this sort of repression. So Sufis are, you won't find them everywhere in the Muslim world now, or at least they might be underground in some places. And it's quite a real conflict since 2005, you know, it's still going on. Over 200 people have been killed in Pakistan in attacks on 29 Sufi shrines. And that's Muslims killing other Muslims. Often during festivals, when the shrines are crowded, there have been attacks on Sufis in Kashmir, in India. The Ashabab group, again, a very fundamentalist Salafi type of group in Somalia, has attacked Sufis. In the city of Timbuktu in Mali, there were also attacks by Salafi groups there. In Egypt, the 2011 revolution, they banned several Sufi festivals after that. And in 2017, there was an appalling attack, you might remember this, on a Sufi mosque in Sinai by an Islamist group, and over 300 people died. So it's ongoing. There have been attacks on Sufis in Libya and Tunisia, In Iran, they're very much under threat. Sufi shrines have been bulldozed in Iran, and every now and then the government says it's going to stop all Sufi activity. There are a couple of smaller Sufi orders that support the government. They're usually left alone, but the unregulated ones, if you like, are sort of under threat. In Saudi Arabia, Sufi orders were expelled as early as 1843, and all Sufi orders were illegal from the 1970s up to 2006. Now, that's now been relaxed, and there seems to be a little bit of a renaissance in Sufism in Saudi Arabia. Sufi thought has also spread to the West, partly because the universalistic aspects make it much easier. So a lot of people are quite interested in Sufism without necessarily converting to Islam at all. And this sort of started off with an Indian professor of all things of musicology called Inayat Khan. He was a Sufi and a poet, and he promulgated Sufism in America and in Europe from about 1910 to 1926. And he set up something called the Sufi Order in London in 1918. And he belonged personally to four different Sufi orders, including the Chishti. And he saw his mission as uniting all the Abrahamic faiths and the Indian, the Vedic tradition of monotheism. His organization later split up. There are all sorts of succession fights, and there are several different branches. So things called the Sufi Movement, the International Sufi Center, the Sufi Way, Sufis Reoriented. All those are modern Western offshoots from Inayat Khan. And as I said, they're very prominent in interfaith work. I think there are some Jewish Sufis in Israel, as far as I know. I remember coming across somebody once. And as I said, a lot of Sufis quite prominent in peace movements around the world. We talked about the Naqshbandi Center in the Old City. They're also active in an organization called Jerusalem Peacemakers. And that was very much Sufi participation. So Sufism is still a very major grassroots force around the world. And it tends to the peaceful and the liberal, and is often supported by, you know, Western governments for that reason, because these are not the people who are going out for bombs. These are usually much more universalistic and ecumenically minded people. I've put some books here to if you want to pursue this further. I have to say, Anne-Marie Schimmel, I have read her all the way through. She's tough going. The other ones are easier to read. This is the best translation I could find of the Rumi. You want to watch out for some translations of sort of, there's been an accusation that some translations take the Islam out of Rumi. He definitely was a from Muslim. So some of them sort of denature it. So it's just sort of universal and nothing at all about the Quran and Muhammad. Whereas his original was very much about the Islamic tradition. So you want to watch out for some of the more popular translations of Rumi. They're not apparently very accurate. Okay, so let's go back to the chat and see what questions we have here. Instead of Kabbalah 49 steps, we have 42 steps. I'm not sure which variant of Kabbalah you're talking about. There are 10 Sfirot. I'm not sure we have 42 steps. I'm not quite sure who the we is there either. 42 is borrowed from the Jewish name tradition or inherent Islam. I honestly don't know if it has a particular meaning in Islam. They are interested in numbers, like what most religions are, but I don't know if 42 has a particular meaning. 99 does. There's a tradition of 99 beautiful names of God, which many Muslims make a practice of reciting. You may have seen those sort of worry bee things. You can get ones with 99 beads that, you know, for recitation of the names of God, and some people will do that. And that's quite a Sufi practice too. Yes, interesting, as Rambam and the Summer are famous for their rationalist bent. Yes, in I think both in Judaism and Islam, you get people who are simultaneously halakhic experts. And Joseph Caro is another example, but also have a rich inner and mystical life. And I don't see it as contradictory at all. So that idea of, you know, to pursue personal interior spirituality doesn't seem to them to be separate at all from being rationalist. To some extent, Fanal Betula Yesh sounds like Nirvana. A little bit, yes. Though, whereas in the monotheistic tradition, it's usually the abolition of the individual self in front of God. In Hinduism, Buddhism, it's just release into ultimate being. And it's much less, you don't have a single personal God. So it's just all encompassing isness. It's lacks the personal quality there. In Chadash Tachat HaShemesh, indeed. Please repeat or post the names of J authors, rabbis, and names of guides. Well, there's Yona Girondi, who wrote a manual. There's the anonymous Orchot HaTzadikim from the 14th century. You can get a nice Feldheim translation, both of those, I think. There is Moshe Chaim Luzzatto, who wrote Misilat Yesharim, The Path of the Upright, also translated by Feldheim. So all those manuals are available in English, if you're interested in any of those. As we said before, Sufism cuts across Shiite, Sunni. It's more an orientation rather than a particular line of who is the successor of Muhammad. Link with sources that's there. We answered about discrimination in Muslim countries. Depends which. The thing is, Sufism is so widespread and so much an integral part of popular Islamic culture that it's very difficult to weed out. Saudi Arabia more or less did it because they've been at it for 100 years. Though it's interesting that actually it's coming back now. But places like Morocco, Sufism is very alive and well, and Pakistan too. And it's very, very real and lively and grassrooty force. Might have Buber's Eye and That, which I've never read, but I'll take your word for that one. Losing oneself is like Pitul HaYesh. Yes, well, we were talking about Fana being a bit like Pitul HaYesh, yeah. Khalil Gibran comes out of Muslim tradition, but it's his own thing. I don't even know if he regarded himself as a Muslim. But he comes from that tradition of Persian poetry that goes back to Rumi. So it's related to it. I'm not sure if he thought of himself as a Sufi. You'd have to look it up. He's originally from Lebanon, but that tradition of poetry with imagery is very, very central in Islamic, particularly in Sufi thought. So I would guess, without knowing definitely, that he's related to it, but I'm not sure if he would be seen as an example of the Sufi. Yes, they're interfaith meetings. Years ago, I attended a Jewish and Sufi breakfast in Toronto. Ah, sponsored by a Reform Synagogue and Sufi Mosque. Yes, they tend to be very friendly. One can avoid the commercial dancing in Istanbul and search for rural order to see authentic Dervish dancing. Awesome experience. Oh, my heavens. Sounds amazing. Well, if I get to Turkey, I will try and do that. There's a large community of Sufis in Albania, which may explain Albania's decent treatment of, I'm presuming, Jews in World War II. Albania had more Jews after the war than prior to it, of course, we're speaking small numbers. Yes, Albania has quite a major refuge tradition. There was a group in Iran who started off as pretty fanatic and then changed their mind, decided they were peaceful, and fled to Iraq, and then were under terrible, terrible threat in Iraq. There were about 3,000 to 4,000 of them. They got moved once. But did lose some members because they were under enormous danger, I think, particularly from ISIS. And Albania took them. So they're now living very happy in Albania. 42 is the answer. This is a great question of the University of Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. Indeed, maybe Douglas Adams knew something about Sufi literature that I'm not too sure he did, but maybe he was going back to the Jewish tradition, the 42 letter name of God. I really don't know where he got 42 from at all. Okay, are there any other questions at all? If you want to get a taste, I'd recommend choosing one of these books and maybe Rumi. Rumi's a great writer, it's a lot of fun. Ibn Atta, who we mentioned as preserving the traditions of Rabia, also wrote his own work called The Conference of the Birds, which again is a parable, a very long parable in which birds are the characters. They all come together to make a pilgrimage to see the legendary king of the birds, the Simurgh, who's a sort of a type of bird that doesn't exist, but he survived from ancient Persian mythology. And there are lots of stories about their journey to see the Simurgh, and when they get there, they realize that they didn't need to travel there because already he was there in their hearts. So it's a fable about the mystical journey to God, and there are a lot of them. A great many. Some of the greatest works, particularly of poetry in Persian, is Sufi poetry. And it's, I think people don't sort of say, oh, it's Sufi. They just think, oh, it's just this fabulous poetry, particularly people from those countries who still hugely, hugely value them. I mean, Rumi is enormously respected worldwide by Muslims. Okay. Righty-ho. So next week I will see you, and we're going to finish up with a comparative look at covering up in the Islamic and Jewish traditions, hijab in the Islamic tradition, and various forms of married women's covering up in the Jewish tradition, and concepts of modesty in both. So I'll see you for that next week.
Thanks.
Thank you.